Many couples need medical intervention in order to start a family. In fact, fertility problems affect 10% of women in the United States. That's about 6.1 million people. Hi, John Munson here, sitting in for Larry Mueller today. We'll find out over the next 45 minutes what the common causes of infertility are and what you can do now to prevent fertility problems in the future. My guest is Dr. Christy Broadwell, assistant professor in the Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology, Reproductive Endocrinology, and Infertility at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And, of course, she's happy to answer your questions. Here's how to get in touch. 800-642-1234 is the toll-free number, 800-642-1234. You can also leave a comment or question on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page or send us an email. The address is talk@WPR.org. Dr. Broadwell, thanks for joining me today.
Thank you so much for having me.
So let's start by defining some terms. When we use the term infertility, what are we talking about?
Well, when we use and think about the term infertility, or another kind of term often used is subfertility, it really does encompass, again, individuals and or couples that have been trying to conceive a pregnancy through over a period of time but have been unable to. For the most general definition, that's after a year of having unprotected intercourse and attempts to conceive without being successful in those attempts at that time. That definition, though, is a little bit different depending on kind of age of an individual or couple, and so that amount of time can be shortened based upon some of those criteria as well. But in general, that's where we start.
Okay. In the introduction to this segment, we're talking about 10% of women in the United States who have issues with fertility. Is there a number on the number, a percentage number for men as well?
You know, I think we have a little more information, you know, necessarily in a lot of these surveys as it kind of leads to women. However, there is some information as well that married women or women in a couple, about 1.5 million women in couples in the United States are infertile. So that's around 6%. So that would also be, I think, about at that same range.
Okay. So what are the most common causes of fertility problems?
Yeah, you know, I think, you know, when I think about the field, the most common causes, you know, we focus mainly on kind of the three things that are needed. We need an egg that's available on a regular basis. We need sperm in a high enough number to make a trip to fertilize that egg. And we need a clear path. So most oftentimes we focus on those three sources. And so we can see that even, you know, couples or individuals, when couples, the male partner, about 40% of the time will identify a factor that is solely, you know, involved in sperm production and or function. The rest 40% or another 40% are kind of more female related, whether that's to the release of that egg or having difficulty regulating their menstrual cycles. And then possibly too, having any barrier into communication or the introduction of those two through any sort of adhesions or any process that blocks that sort of that path within the reproductive tract and or fallopian tubes.
Okay, so let's talk about those things specifically then and kind of what goes into that. What would prevent a woman from being able to produce eggs?
Yeah, you know, there can be many different reasons. And the communication, as a woman goes through puberty and sort of goes through those pubertal changes, it's sort of the start of the function of the ovary. And that function ultimately is involved in having a mature egg that's able to be fertilized by sperm. Now, that process is a complicated one. It's one that I think I spent, you know, many years of medical school and training, but it really is a complicated communication between the master gland in the brain called the pituitary and the ovary. There's a lot of different hormones, a lot of different signals that are involved to make each step a coordinated one in order to lead to the development of that follicle and egg, the production of hormone called estrogen, as well as the release of that egg at the appropriate time. Following the release of that egg, that's when fertilization can occur. And then the second half of that cycle is sort of promotion of allowing an embryo to implant and the production of progesterone. So all of that coordination oftentimes occurs within, you know, the quote-unquote average of a month, whether that's 28 days. It can also be shorter at approximately 21 to 24 days and up to 35 days and still happen on a regular basis. But all of that communication is devoted to the release of that one egg in most instances, and that's a lot of times, if there's any sort of difficulty with communication between those, there can be disruptions to that production.
So it's a pretty complex mechanism with a lot of opportunities for mischief.
That's a perfect summation. Yeah.
Okay. All right. 800-642-1234 if you have questions about fertility and problems with fertility and what to do. We have the expert with us here to talk about it. Dr. Christy Broadwell is here until about 12:30 to answer your questions. 800-642-1234. So you mentioned that the path can be blocked by adhesions. Talk about how do those happen and what are they?
Yeah, and I think that, you know, for every individual, there can be different, but some of the most common causes that we can have sort of obstructed path in from the female perspective is, you know, history of having a tubal ligation. If that was occurred thinking that fertility kind of potential had been reached, but a change of heart occurred, that can often be one common cause. Others can include infections such as gonorrhea, chlamydia. You know, those that are treated, we see kind of less consequence. However, if they remained untreated, we can have... we also want to screen for that to ensure that none of those were present. You know, processes such as prior surgeries on the fallopian tubes and or ovaries for a number of reasons, and one of those includes endometriosis, where you can have implants of endometrium or endometrial type tissue outside the uterus that can cause, again, that difficulty in that openness of the fallopian tube.
So you mentioned that some men don't either don't produce sperm in enough quantity or there's something wrong with it. What tends to cause that?
Yeah, there can be a number of factors there. And I think that overall, when we think about all of the work that goes into the production of, you know, kind of usually one egg every month for a reproductive cycle, when we think about the male reproductive tract and sperm production, when we think about how many sperm are in the ejaculate, it's at the magnitude of 20 to 40 million sperm that are moving and modal within that sample. So we do see it's a very different mode of production. Of all men, about 1% will find don't make any sperm at all or produce any modal sperm in their ejaculate. And that increases to about 10 to 15% of men that are a part of a couple or an individual presenting to a subfertility or infertility clinic for treatments. So a lot of times we look at that. We look at, is it a blockage, similarly to what we can see in the fallopian tubes of women, or is it a production problem? And about overall, when we think about lack of sperm, it can be about 50-50, and in other causes, it can just be that there are lower numbers produced.
Mm-hmm. So when you see somebody, you've got a couple, they want to conceive and are having problems, what are some of the things that that you can tell them about that would have positive effects on fertility?
Yeah, and I think a couple of things is just also increased awareness and education, things like this to sort of talk about, okay, when are these opportune times and when are kind of the best opportunities to conceive? I think those are very important steps. Also looking at smoking cessation is one big thing. We do see lots of studies. Again, they often are observational and maybe not the best kind of rigorous type of study, but smoking cessation has been associated with decreased fecundability in men and women. Also optimizing health. Overall health is important, again, for maintaining the reproductive system at its best, whether that's optimizing the extremes of both being over and underweight and maintaining a healthy diet.
800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Let's take a call from Barb, who's calling us from Jackson today. Barb, hello.
Hi, I just wanted to talk a little bit about my son and his wife went to a fertility specialist for a year. They did two IUIs, didn't work. They both had issues. The doctor said 3 to 5% chance that they would get pregnant on their own as opposed to in vitro. We sought out alternative therapies. She also stopped working nights. We had Reiki, and it's called EFT, Emotional Freedom Therapy, which is tapping. We're having a baby in December. And we were, you know, the hope was taken away. So I think reducing stress, nutrition is really important. And then also just sort of relaxing and not trying so hard.
Dr. Broadwell?
Yeah, you know, I think that I think stress overall is a very, is something that we should all reduce in our life and can have a lot of very negative impacts on overall health as well. And I think what's really tough is it's hard to get, again, good studies to kind of point and give us direction when stress is such a difficult thing to really have a black and white definition of. And it's a really hard thing to control for each individual and to sort of see couples or individuals to only change levels of stress. I think it's hard to find studies that can, again, support different types. However, I think in our clinic, we also take a lot of steps to try to control that stress, knowing that you can't always get rid of it, but more it's about trying to kind of lessen it as much as possible. And there are many therapies that are available. And I think that overall, taking care of yourself is a very important step in overall health, as well as when trying to achieve a pregnancy. And I think that it's true that sometimes percentages that are quoted with treatments may not always be the same with continued natural attempts. And everyone's different. And so I think it's hard to take some successes in some of those fields and directly relate them to a different individual and or couple. But I think that all of those things, if they can promote overall health and well-being, can be an important step in just maintaining, I think, emotional health as well as physical health.
Barb, thanks for calling and congratulations. Let's go quickly to Pat in Suamico, and we're just about at news time, Pat, so I'll thank you to be brief.
I would like to know more about infertility from polycystic ovaries, and if the ovaries are removed, is there long-term effects?
No, it's an excellent question, and I think that goes back to an earlier question that was asked in sort of some of the common causes of subfertility or infertility, and PCOS is one of the most common impacts on ovulation. So absolutely, it is something that can affect between 6 to 10% of reproductive age women, and it leads to, again, difficulty in communication between the brain and the ovary to make an egg available on a monthly regular basis, and it can lead to lack of cycles. Never, again, sort of having that coordinated message to have a menstrual bleed every month. It can lead to menstrual bleeding that occurs very irregularly, sometimes every 3 months, sometimes more, sometimes less. That bleeding can also be heavy. What's very interesting is when we first discovered this disorder, we thought mostly about the reproductive aspects of it, and we were able to identify medications that could help restore that communication between the brain and the ovary. Therapies such as clomiphene citrate or Clomid, another is Femara or Letrozole, which basically helps to reset that communication in the hopes that will promote the development of a mature follicle and egg, and that can be quite successful depending on this clinical situation. Sometimes other adjuvant therapies are needed to kind of help that communication. But also, too, we've come to realize that there's also other medical concerns in the realm of PCOS that can lead to higher rates in certain individuals of high blood pressure, high cholesterol, and obesity. And so those are long-lasting impacts that can also affect the health of an individual.
800-642-1234, the number to call to join the program. If you have questions about fertility and treatment for infertility, the causes and so forth, this is the hour to do it, and we'll be taking a break in about a minute and a half to catch up on the latest news for National Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Radio. But after that, we'll be on for another 25 minutes or so with Dr. Broadwell to talk about infertility and how this problem is being handled. And even one of the things I want to get to before the end of the program today is to maybe talk about some of the research that's taking place now and some of the promise that that holds, because certainly there are a lot of couples out there that would really love to be able to conceive and just haven't been able to do so for one reason or another. Well, we're discussing what can be done in those situations, some of the things that can cause infertility, and some ways to improve your chances of being able to have a baby. Dr. Christy Broadwell is my guest. I'm John Munson, in for Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's not uncommon for couples to seek medical help to begin having children. Our guest today is talking about when it's time to speak with your doctor if you think you may be having fertility problems. John Munson here, sitting in for Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network. Thanks for joining us today. Dr. Christy Broadwell is the assistant professor in the Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology, Reproductive Endocrinology and Infertility at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Dr. Broadwell, before the news, we had a caller who had some questions regarding what are called PCOs and ovary removal, and I think you had a few more points you wanted to make about that.
Yeah, I wanted to, you know, kind of gave a quick little blurb on polycystic ovary syndrome, or PCOS, and I think it's, again, it's a very complex disease process, and wanted to sort of stress too that, yes, it is one of the leading causes of difficulty releasing an egg or ovulation every month, but I also think what makes it unique and different from some of the other situations where that can be the result is the fact that it also has other clinical manifestations that can be both distressing and need management. And I sort of touched on some of that, including obesity, high blood pressure, diabetes, and those precursor disease processes leading to those, but also, one of the hallmark signs and symptoms of that are two other things. One is increased androgens or testosterone-like hormones that are released from the body, whether that be from the ovary and or adrenal gland, as well as something that we call the polycystic ovary, appearance to the ovary. And what we find is that can have impacts on sort of overall function of the ovary that can also lead to things like acne, hair growth that can be distressing both on the face and on abdomen and chest to varying levels and varying degrees. And all of those, I think, are very important aspects of offering the best treatment for individuals and couples that are facing this disease process and trying to overcome all of those obstacles.
So for couples who are who believe that they are facing some fertility issues, how long should they wait until they take action and bring this up with their doctor?
Yeah, you know, I think if they are noticing menstrual irregularities, which is the most common hallmark of, is an egg available every month? Having predictable menstrual cycles that occur kind of on a predictable basis for a predictable amount of time are good indicators. If that's not happening, I think it's time to sort of talk to a physician or a doctor about, okay, what's going on with that, even as it's not related to fertility, to make sure that all of that is functioning normally. I think that, again, we had sort of talked about earlier that definition under the age of 30 for women of subfertility or infertility is trying for a year without conception. As age increases above the age of 35, we say at 6 months, I think it's very prudent to start asking questions and investigating if therapies and or workups are appropriate for you. And after the age of 40, oftentimes for women, even if initial attempts are being considered, it's maybe time to really start investigating due to the age-related fertility decline that we can see. And so really, time is of the essence. And in those circumstances, you know, waiting less than 6 months, even in the first 1 or 2 months of trying, I think it's time for us to make sure all of those pieces are in place. And if there's anything we need to augment or to help facilitate, I think it's better to do that earlier rather than later.
Well, go ahead.
I also think from a male perspective, I think any difficulty, you know, with reaching erection, ejaculation for men is sometimes a sign that their reproductive access, you know, just like for the brain to the ovary, the brain to the testicle can also be impaired. And so I think that's important, as well as if there's any sort of family history of male kind of difficulty, male factor, subfertility, or other medical problems that need to be sort of addressed within the male population as well. Because as, you know, we stated earlier, it's men contributing to that subfertility is equal to that of a female contributing to the cause of infertility.
We had a caller who wanted you to explain what unexplained fertility means.
No, great question. And I think it's one that is one of the most difficult things. And it's basically a title or the description we give to couples that in our investigation we find out that through menstrual history and other testing and parameters, we determine that, yes, there's evidence that ovulation is happening on a regular monthly basis. In our investigations to look at fallopian tubes, we also see that there is no abnormality within anatomy of the uterus and or fallopian tube, and we see normal sperm counts. In these individuals, it's particularly frustrating, and this can affect between 25 to 30% of couples that we see because we just can't identify any sort of disorder within those three major components to conceive. And that can just be a really difficult thing when we see all the players that are there, but for some reason, we haven't been able to bring them all together for the desired outcome that we hope to achieve.
Let's take a phone call from Randy in calling in from Sauk County today. Randy, good afternoon.
Yeah, hi. 35 years ago, or maybe 37 now, we after we'd been married, we married a little later. We were in our late 20s, and wanted to have children right away. We knew, and of course couldn't, and so went in for a workup, and lo and behold, at least half the problem was mine. I was diabetic, and my blood sugars were swinging, and I didn't have good control on that, and other health issues. And my wife had a combined problem. So the doctor looked at us, and he said, well, you've got a 2% chance. Do you want to still work with it? Well, I said, yeah, let's go. Well, long story is, it started a pattern of good health, I think, and just inching forward like a glacier. And 3 years later, I said, we found the 15 minutes in life that we could conceive, and four times, almost 3 years to the day, we had four children. And we've laughed later because, you know, we've said, as hard as it is to raise children, it's too bad everybody doesn't have to work that hard to get them, you know, so... I actually think there's something good about going to a doctor and having him say, you know, this has a lot of problems, and I can't magically, do a wand, but if you're willing to work with these small percentages, well, I found that encouraging, you know. So anyway, I think as far as when I hear a lady is talking to another lady, I think, well, where's the man? It could very well be that there's a combined problem, and they have to look at this as an adventure, you know, go forward, inch forward like a glacier, you know.
Randy, thanks so much for telling us your story. How common in your experience is what Randy just told us?
Absolutely. That's a great personal story. That's fantastic. And I'm so happy to hear of the successes that they were able to achieve. And I think that he brings up a number of good points. And I think that, yes, that sometimes it is sort of about trying to be positive throughout the process, reducing stress in order to sort of take on this adventure either alone or together as a couple. I think that that can be a very strengthening, both to an individual as well as a couple. I think it's difficult, but sometimes to try to actively take on that perspective can be helpful as you're going through these different treatments. Not always easy, but definitely helpful.
Well, let's talk about the treatments. What treatments are out there, and how do we know which one is right for us?
Yeah, no, great. You know, and I think that the first thing to figure that out is really, yeah, coming, you know, in for and hearing that personal story of what's been going on and sort of doing some of that testing, whether that be through the use of home testing, ovulation predictor kits, us drawing hormone levels at certain times of the cycle to assess that all of those parameters are in place and functioning at the intervals that we would expect them to. The second is some of that testing is something called an HSG or an ultrasound with SIS. And so those are some terms that we look at, the patency of the fallopian tubes and doing a semen analysis to, again, as the last caller brought up, make sure that there isn't a male factor that's contributing to this subfertility or infertility. I think the treatments are then tailored on any of those things that we see may not be at their optimal place.
Well, we read stories, and we hear stories about women who get fertility drugs, and then all of a sudden they are pregnant with quintuplets or something like that. How often does that happen?
Yeah, you know, I think that overall, a lot of that is dependent on the type of treatment. Yep, absolutely. So fertility drugs, there's a number of different types. With the first sort of category that I think of are those that are basically found in pill form, and that's clomiphene citrate, Clomid, and or Letrozole Femara. The next step in helping produce an egg or more eggs than just one every month are injections of the pituitary hormone that helps the development of those follicles and the release of that egg. And most commonly, that's where we really see those higher order multiples, because again, we're taking away the ovary's ability to talk back to the brain to stop the production of that hormone. We've taken it over. And so now we can take this to a level that again goes again far and beyond what that natural system is set up to do. And so oftentimes we go to those steps in those therapies when prior therapies haven't been effective. And again, those are found to have less side effect and less risk, such as that of the higher order multiples.
And what about in vitro fertilization?
Yeah, so in vitro fertilization is a way that we sort of help open up that target with when we think about trying to promote the production of eggs. When we think about eggs and sperm coming together in the fallopian tube or in the body, we want to make sure that we keep that number of eggs available at a healthy range, and we don't want to necessarily have too many eggs coming in contact with too many sperm. When we do things like in vitro fertilization, what we're able to do is promote the production of available eggs and then remove those eggs from the body through an outpatient procedure. We do that and bring sperm and egg together in the laboratory and then have the laboratory function as that fallopian tube and basically have embryo development occur there from anywhere from 3 to 5 days, and then transfer an appropriate number of embryos back to the uterus following that development. If there are more embryos available through egg and sperm coming together, there's also the option of freezing those for later use. And so we're able to try to optimize the cycle potential each month by bringing kind of more eggs into availability, combining those with sperm without, again, hopefully having that same consequence of higher order multiples because we control the number of embryos that are returned to the uterus.
Let's take a call from Danielle in Sauk City next. Danielle, hello.
Hi. I was wondering, my primary care physician had told me about a blood test that can help assess how good your ovaries may be. I was wondering if you could maybe elaborate on that a little bit and kind of explain what it is.
Yeah, no, great question. You know, I think what test they're referring to is a blood test that we can now do, and it's called anti-Müllerian hormone, or AMH. And that's basically a hormone in the blood that we're able to sort of assess the bank account of the ovary every month. As I said earlier, most commonly, there's a lot of work that goes to the release of one egg every month. But what we keep in mind and know, and what science has found, is that there's more than one competing to reach that mature stage. And that can vary. That can be very numerous. That can be 4 of these sort of resting potential follicles or potential eggs that compete to be the one that gets to be ovulated. So if that's 4, if that's 5, if that's 10 or 20, those are different numbers of competing immature eggs to reach that mature egg stage. And so I think of that, if you think of ovulation as a paycheck every month, I think of that reserve as sort of what's in savings. And so what's there and what can we draw from in order to get more? Now, I think what we know is that women get older, there's a smaller bank account every month that's available. And overall, we're trying to see if there are links to, if there are fewer immature eggs available, does that have an impact on quality as well? And that's ongoing research right now, is really starting to dig in and answer and try to come up with answers to those questions. But the biggest predictor of egg quality is age. And that although we're looking for any links of having fewer eggs available at a given time impacting the quality of those eggs, that has not been proven and that has not been established. Overall, though, we do know that as a woman ages, that we see that quality go down. And so it's a little simplistic to think of that potential testing of that ovarian reserve or that bank account as a quality measure. It's more, what are we working with each month? Because when we think of our treatments, we really try to access that availability and try to work with that bank account more. And sometimes we can be more or less successful when there's fewer or more available.
Danielle, thank you for your question. And speaking of bank accounts, are fertility treatments covered by insurance?
You know, for the most part, they are not. I think that, and that's something that is definitely is a challenge when it comes to approaching this treatment. I think in some states it definitely is covered, and I think that there are about 14 states that have different varying levels of insurance coverage. Some are mandatory states where all different treatments are covered, and other states and other insurance policies may cover some therapies but not others. And so it's really important to contact your insurance provider, you know, to see if there are any sort of infertility treatment benefits. That being said, though, I don't want, you know, that concern or worry to stop people from investigating sort of some of the causes that can be contributing, because overwhelmingly that often is covered by insurance, that sort of investigation process to assess if ovulation is happening, if sperm is available, and if there's an open path. A lot of that testing, if treatment hasn't started yet, will often be covered under almost all insurance plans, but it is important to investigate that. We also have financial advisors at our clinic that are available to sort of help you investigate this and figure out what things can be covered and what is not.
All right, Jody in Fond du Lac will be next. Jody, go ahead.
Hi there. I just wanted to share that my husband and I had suffered from infertility for about 6 years, and I'm an educated person, and I had been recommended a book that completely changed my, I guess, understanding of my own body, and I'm disappointed that I wasn't taught this earlier, because I didn't really read this until I was in my mid-30s, but it's a book called Taking Charge of Your Fertility. Perhaps you've heard of it, and it really made me understand about ovulation and what was actually going on in my body. And when I realized and read the book that I wasn't ovulating like a typical textbook person, and then literally about 3 months after following the information that the book shared, I became pregnant. So I just wanted to share that with your readers.
Jody, thanks so much. But knowing yourself and knowing how your own body works, is that'd be pretty critical, wouldn't it, Dr. Broadwell?
Absolutely. And I'm so glad to hear that you found success. And it can be very, you know, frustrating and scary when, again, a lot of this aren't things that are often talked about. And I think that in this increasing education and increasing awareness to kind of help individuals learn more about their body and understand what's going on is an important part of overall health as well as this. And yes, there can be many resources, many books that are available. And I think that sometimes, too, even starting at your doctor's office, because I think that some can be a little more helpful than others, or talk to friends or talk to family members to see what's helped them the most as sort of guides to help in the collection of this information, because it is vitally important.
And what about, I mean, is there, I'm assuming, like everything else, there are probably some myths out there and probably some misinformation. Anything you'd like to clear up?
Yeah, you know, I think that those are that oftentimes during my visits, we will go over, you know, a lot of those myths. And I really encourage patients to not be shy, to really just get it all out there and ask me any question. No question's a stupid question. I think that overall, some of the biggest things that I think that I have heard, and one that comes to mind right away, is that certain positions can be improve fecundity or fecundability of each cycle, that, you know, laying down for 10 minutes afterwards, all of those are really unproven. And so those are big ones right there that I can think of right off the top of my head. But definitely, you know, bring those in, write them down. No question's a stupid question. And sometimes we even have to look to sort of see what is behind all of this.
Well, what about the effects of age on fertility potential?
Yeah, I think overall, you know, we see that age has the biggest impact on women, and that they really see what we can find is a decline in fertility that really kind of starts in the early 30s by 32. That's a slow decline that then can increase kind of in that rate of decline after the age of 38. So that's a big component of, you know, kind of risk of having difficulty conceiving and different treatments that may be more appropriate for certain individuals. Men, it appears, don't have that same kind of drop or decrease rate of fertile potential as they get older, but we do see it. And oftentimes it's over the age of 45, over the age of 50. And we can see other impacts that are associated with advanced paternal age over the age of 45, finding certain disease processes that can be more common in conceived children, but overall their fertility does not decline as much as that for women.
And what about family history, genetic predisposition? Is there research that reveals something here?
I think that it's difficult. I think that overall, if there is a family history of genetic disease, such as cystic fibrosis, that's a big red flag that there could be difficulties conceiving. If there is a family history of chromosomal abnormalities that is frequent in multiple generations, those can be some signs that there could be some more difficulties with conception. But we do find that there are some ovulatory processes, such as PCOS, that if a mother has PCOS, there is a higher incidence of PCOS in her daughter. However, it is not 100%. And so difficulty with conception in one generation does not always mean there will be difficulty in the subsequent generation. And I think the biggest thing that we often will see is the opposite, where there was no difficulty, you know, in earlier generations, but now having more difficulty as an individual of later generations. And in fact, we think a lot of that is related to sort of advancing ages in marriage, advancing ages in attempts to become pregnant as well, that we've seen kind of as the years have gone on.
We have about a minute and a half or so left. Are there any promising new developments on the horizon when it comes to fertility?
Yeah, you know, I think that overall, we find we really have seen great advancements in, I think most specifically, our kind of most intense treatments, including IVF. Really, the IVF laboratories have become so much better and are really making strides in both the support of early embryo growth as well as our ability to control and decrease the number of embryos transferred back to the uterus due to this ability to support them for so long, the ability to cryopreserve embryos as well as sperm, eggs as well to sort of help kind of delay that reproductive potential if there is going to be sort of medical conditions that are going to reduce chance of natural conception. All of those things have really given us great tools in sort of treating patients as well as their future health.
All right, Dr. Broadwell, thank you so much for spending this time with us today.
Oh, thank you so much. It was a great time.
Dr. Christy Broadwell is assistant professor in the Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology, Reproductive Endocrinology, and Infertility at the UW-Madison. Cheyenne Lentz produced this hour of broadcasting and also handled on-air production. Thanks also to Dave Potratz, who helped out with on-air production as well. Tomorrow, we're going to talk about a special opportunity coming up this month to enjoy Wisconsin state parks and forests for free. That's tomorrow morning at 11 on The Larry Miller Show. I'm John Munson, in for Larry Miller, and a reminder that you're listening to this program on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. See you tomorrow.